she comes in and I guess and I tell my buddy I'm working with, he's, I'm like, dude, there's a tiger shark over there. He's like, yeah, don't worry about her. She's fine. Just carry on with your business. And I'm like, Roger that. So had it up, jumped in the water, you know, and at that point you have to maintain your focus. You can't think and create this story of what could happen, because that is going to be your own worst enemy. You know, especially guys who dive in black water, you dive in black water, just close your eyes. Don't start thinking about what's in the dark, because the second you do that, that's when you start getting paranoia. You start getting, you know, you're hyperventilating, your heart rate jumps, and then that's when bad things can go even worse. So, you know, you got to just remain calm. And my experience of that is true in this dive I had just off the coast of California here, where we were working for the Edison power plant, the nuclear power plant, I should say, just off Camp Pendleton. And we were making a lot of noise. We were core drilling into this concrete structure that sits over the pipelines that take the water in to cool the reactors. And as we're making all kinds of noise, you know, we're like bringing in all kinds of just sea life. I mean, there was sheep's head, you know, calico bass, halibut, lobsters were, you know, as far as the eye can see, dude. I mean, they were everywhere. But yeah, I mean, as we're doing this, you know, we're working, and all of a sudden we see this about 13 to 15 foot, maybe, great white coming into the job site.
Oh, boy.
And as we're sitting there, like, I'm looking at it and I can communicate with my diver. So for those listening who don't know, we can communicate to each other underwater. So I tell my other buddy, like, hey, man, what do you want to do? And he's like, don't worry about it. Just keep working. And as a diver, you're safer. You're safer in the water when it comes to sharks than you are, say, swimming or surfing. But like I said, don't let that shy you away from going in the ocean, because you're more likely to get attacked or get struck by lightning than attacked by a shark. My name is Blake Riddle.
I'm Dylan Harrell, and this is the Tom Rowland Podcast.
Today's podcast is a little bit different. We're going to go and visit some guys in Southern California that have a podcast called Break Down the Dive. And these guys work in basically on the ocean, in the ocean lifestyle. They are underwater divers, commercial underwater divers. But man, what an eye opener. What all goes into being an underwater commercial diver? These guys are committed to helping other people both learn about what it is that they do, but also helping people who are interested in doing something like what they're doing, helping them to determine what that path is and make that a reality. I think it's super cool. It's very similar to a lot of the things that we talk about on this podcast. But Break Down the Dive is a cool podcast. I've been listening to a bunch of episodes, and these guys are awesome. We've got we have Blake Riddle. That's not very hard to say, but I made it much harder than it seemed. Blake Riddle and Dylan Harrell are from Break Down the Dive, and they are coming up next. If you like this podcast, go to Apple Podcasts and give it a 5-star rating and review. That would be awesome. And if you want to be on the inner circle, go text the word TEAM, TEAM, to 305-930-7346. That's how to do it. Now stay tuned for this awesome show with Break Down the Dive and Dylan and Blake. Blake, Dylan, what's up, man? How you guys doing?
Good, man. How are you?
Doing great.
Doing great. Doing awesome. Where are you guys right now?
We are currently in Costa Mesa, California, just outside Newport.
Beautiful right. Southern California.
Right on. You got your surfboard, you got your dive helmet. Looks awesome, man. How close are you to the beach?
Walking probably about 15, driving about 5.
Nice. Nice. How's the surf these days?
Right now it says 4 to 6 on the report, but man, I think there's a little bit of surf lie there.
Yeah. It didn't look that big.
Yeah. I think they're fooling us. So
sometimes you got to just go check it out yourself, right?
Yeah. You can't always trust the report. You got to just kind of suit up and get out there
for sure.
Right on. So Man, you guys are in a different world. I mean, we share the love for the outdoors, and you got some commercial fishing background, and you've got all this other stuff. But man, your podcast is super cool. I think Break Down the Dive is the name of your podcast, and it's about, you know, I mean, you frame it nicely. Like, this podcast is designed for people that are interested or intrigued by working underwater, you know, basically. And that's what you guys, that's your gig, right?
Yeah, it has a center point around commercial diving. And we kind of revolve that around an ocean lifestyle per se, you know, captains within the maritime industry and people that want to get involved with an ocean lifestyle. So, I mean, we absolutely love the ocean. And I'm sure, as you know, when the salt water gets a hold of your bloodstream, you can't get away from it, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So what's the backstory of how you guys got into this lifestyle?
Well, in total, 7 years ago, I was working in the restaurant industry. And as I was working around these coworkers of mine, and it just didn't seem exciting. You know, the people that I was working with were pretty unhappy with their job. And I'm just like, you know, I don't want to take that same road. So I started looking into ocean-based work, and I came across the video of a diver in the Gulf of Mexico, hard hat diver, who was working on a jacket, which is basically the structure that holds up the oil rigs that are offshore and produce the oil. And as he was working on this rig, unbeknownst to him, a green sea turtle started making its way up to him from behind, and it kind of nipped him on the shoulder. And I'm watching this at about the age of 20 years old or so. and just like, my eyes are stuck to the screen. I can't take my eyes off it. And the sea turtle nips him on the shoulder. He turns around and starts petting the sea turtle. And I'm like, dude, this guy's working at 200 feet, getting paid to pet a sea turtle. And I lost it. I was like, from that point, I was like researching, you know, what do I got to do? Well, what is this? And I ended up finding a school out in Jacksonville, Florida. And I decided to go like a month and a half later. I quit my job, went straight to Jacksonville, Florida. I completed my 6-month training, which is how long the school is. And after that, I went straight back to the West Coast. I decided to get involved in ship husbandry. And I was,
wait a minute. That's a term I'm not familiar with, ship husbandry. I know animal husbandry.
Okay. So ship husbandry is just repair, maintenance, and upkeep of any vessel at sea. Okay. Or
at sea, not at port, but at sea. You're going to do the maintenance
in the port as well.
Yeah. Okay. In the port. Any ship, whether it's on, it can be considered ship husbandry, even if a ship is, say, within the Great Lakes.
Okay.
So it's just repair and maintenance on vessels. But I was lucky. My company that I started with, they had two branches within their office here on the West Coast. They have a construction department as well as a ship husbandry department, which allows you to be able to acquire skill sets that some guys might not be able to access due to the fact that the company strictly does one thing. So after that, I fell in love with it. You know, I fell in love with the whole entire industry, putting on the helmet, putting on the gear, getting in the water. It was always a challenge. And I saw a need for people wanting to get involved in this and not knowing truly what to do.
Yeah.
So I, you know, very quickly started making connections with people, and I wanted to make the, the mindset is much different than mine, as far as the way the guys in the industry operate. Like, it's kind of very, I'm up here, you're down here, and you know, I'm not going to come down to your level and help you. So I don't want to be that kind of guy. And this guy right here, Dylan, he doesn't want to be that kind of guy. So we decided to be able to start this whole thing with the mindset of, we want to help people that are involved in the ocean, whether it's fishing, whether it's surfing, if they want to progress in their sport and their passion, this is what this is about. But commercial diving is at its center.
Yeah.
So that's where I started Hang and Let Apparel, which then eventually transitioned into Break Down the Dive. And at that point, I brought Dylan Harrell on board as a co-host and a partner.
Nice. That's awesome, man. That's a cool story, because it's similar. I don't know, similar to my story as well. I like to help people get involved. We talk a lot about on this podcast about how somebody might become a fishing guide or a hunting guide or you know, because when I started as a fishing guide, I hadn't taken very many charters. I haven't taken many guided trips. I didn't know any fishing guides. And the thought of working as a fishing guide as a real career was, it seemed impossible. Like it didn't even seem impossible. It just seemed like something that didn't exist. Like I remember this day of me going, you could do that. And like, that could be like what you would do for the rest of your life. And it just didn't seem like, I mean, if you don't know anyone that does something like that, you've never met anyone that does something like that. It's not even an impossibility. It's just not even something that you would consider. Right. So just like you just opening people's minds to, well, yeah, like people are going down there and they're repairing these things. And yes, that's what they do for a living. In fact, they probably make a ton of money doing it. And you could do it too, like that. So that's kind of the path that you guys are taking. And so what about you? What's your story?
All right. So I was working in retail at a younger age, and I quickly decided I didn't want to follow that passion.
Retail?
So yeah, I was working at Home Depot for about a year and a half or something.
Okay.
Anyways, got out of that. I went to welding school, became a welder for some companies out in the Central Valley of California. Did a lot of fabricating, built lots of gates for canals and waterways. And then I decided, I'm an adrenaline junkie, so I decided to cut my ties there and head off to Alaska and see what commercial fishing was all about. Mm-hmm. So I was in Alaska for about 5 years on a longliner between three different vessels in our fleet. And I absolutely, as soon as I stepped foot in Alaska, I was like, this is it, man. I love this.
Yeah.
Being out on the water, being out on the ocean, 40-foot seas, and just adapting and overcoming to all the challenges and things you learn is just amazing.
40-foot seas. That's insane. What, so a longliner in Alaska, what's the fish that you're catching? What are you catching on the longline boat?
So we're going for lean cod.
Okay.
We potentially catch a pollock every now and then. Mm-hmm. We'll bring those up if our quota is allowing that. But our main source of our income there was getting that cod.
So lean cod, what's the depth that longline is fishing?
We are fishing around 300 to 500 feet.
And what's the overall water depth that you're in the areas that you're looking for?
That was, I think it was like around 800, maybe 1,000.
So a lean cod is like a mid-level fish. They like kind of half water depth.
Yeah, but they also like the bottom as well. I mean, every now and then we'll bring up some cod that lines get pulled to the bottom with their anchors and their eyes are huge, you know? Yeah. You know, they were down there.
Yeah, for sure.
Pressure changes.
Yeah.
So it was almost 100% lean cod and a few other fish, or would you have other bycatch?
Those were the two fish. Mostly lean cod. I'd say 90% of it was lean cod.
Over time, those guys have just dialed that fishing in, you know, to where there's almost no bycatch, right?
Like, for sure. Bycatch wasn't. A lot of people think, you know, commercial fishermen out in Alaska catch dolphins and sharks and things like that. On a longliner, it's the most eco-friendly type of fishing. In the 5 years that I've done it out there, I didn't see one single species of that. Hmm. Every now and then, a crab will come up on our line, you know, and we immediately have to put it back. No sharks, dolphins,
because,
no whales.
You know,
on the
other coast, you know, in the Northeast, I know that they are catching tons of sharks, and other type of long lining, they're catching tons of sharks, but that might be a function of the depth and the bait and the time of the year and all that, you know, but
yeah, absolutely.
So what's the hardest thing about that? Because I was about this close to going to Alaska and trying that for myself. And
I think you should still do it, man.
Well, I would love to have the experience and I would love to experience that, but I don't think that I'm hungry enough to go to Alaska and fish on one of those boats. Although I'd like to see it, like, you know, seeing the ocean, like you're talking about 40 footers, that's gnarly as hell, man. And it's like an experience that you don't forget. Like, I'm sure that 40 footers is probably not the most or the biggest seas that you saw or have seen in what you guys are doing. But
I mean, I think I've reached seeing around a 50 foot before.
Dang.
And that's hurricane season out there. And typically, it depends how the captain is, if he wants to still keep going or not. But most of the time we'll stop for like a day or two
with 50 footers. Down.
Yeah. I let it get back down to around 30, 35.
Man, that is,
we've talked about possibly going, he's talked about going back and bringing me with him, and I'm all in. So, you know, if that was,
sounds like you're going.
So, I already got my bag packed, man.
Yeah. So what's the opportunity? I mean, that's, there's always a lure of that. Like you hear about people that go there and do make a lot of money. I mean, even we had, we just had UFC fighter, Clay Guida was on our show recently, and I did a podcast with him, and he went up there and did that.
Oh, nice.
And nice. I don't know if he was doing the exact same kind of fishing that you were, but he was on a fishing boat in Alaska, spent some time there, made a lot of money, and came back. And I've talked to a bunch of other people. In fact, there was this one kid that went, and when he went, you know, he was a pretty healthy looking kid, and when he came back, he was literally worked himself to the bone. Like he had lost so much weight and he was so tired, and we went to lunch right when he got back, and man, I was like, whoa, that is some work. Yeah, he was eating everything he saw, he was cramming it in. And I mean, he lost a good 30 pounds up there, and he was saying he was the guy that was throwing the hook in the type of fishing that he was doing to get the buoy. And if you pass, so I don't know I don't really know a lot about that kind of fishing, but he was explaining it to me, and it was like, look, you got maybe two shots at this buoy, and if you pass it, the captain is going to be super pissed. And
that sounds like long lining.
Yeah. Okay. So whatever it was, he was like, you do not miss that buoy. Like, and if you do, it's, you're getting it back in as fast as you can. But he was working his ass off up there. I mean, like serious freaking work. So, is that your experience? Like, explain what that lifestyle is like.
You're doing around 18 to 20 hour days, depending on how the fishing is, and obviously how your crew is cooperating with the work. I mean, every once in a while, you'll have guys quit mid trip.
Where are they going?
They go to their rack, and that's it. They don't get paid. They got to pay for room and board. And it's the teamwork required for commercial fishing is, it's very important. One guy off the team, man, and everyone's doing 4 hours longer in their day, and you're already doing an 18 hour shift, right? So one guy off the team it takes a big toll on everyone, and everyone gets pretty upset about that. So
I would imagine
I've experienced that a few times, but on a deckhand perspective, see, so you set the gear in the water. We have 60 miles of line you throw out in the water. That takes around 6 hours to do. And immediately you got to haul back. So you go find the end of the line. It takes wherever the captain decided to set the gear. Sometimes it takes 10 minutes to get there, and sometimes it takes, you know, an hour or so. You find the end of the line, you throw your hook in the water, you get your buoys, pull up your line, and that process of pulling in all the line takes around 12 to 16 hours, sometimes 24 hours. And so it's a 24-hour process. Your deck hands are in two shifts, deck one and deck two. And typically when you set the gear, you want all deck hands because it's requires all hands on deck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, man, I mean, it's long days.
I would imagine it's super long days. So how do you go from that to more of a underwater focus?
So what happened was coming into 2018, the state of Alaska was kind of dropping their quota, and the natives were taking a lot of it. And our company couldn't buy much of the quota. We only had so much. So we had to rotate guys more in and out with other boats. We had to dock a few and only had two in operation. So a lot of guys weren't working as much. And so I was thinking of getting into a different industry at the time, due to working my body so hard.
Yeah.
So you chose commercial diving.
I chose commercial diving.
Yeah.
Sounds like you went to the next hardest thing you could find.
Oh, you're right. We were bringing a boat in dry dock, and I saw these guys put on their hard hats and jump in the water, and they're putting the keel blocks in so the boats can come out of the water. And I was looking at my captain, and I was like, what are those guys? He's like, oh, those are the divers. And I was like, are they going underneath our boat right now? And they're like, yeah, they're putting the keel blocks. And I was thinking to myself, like, that's pretty badass. That's cool. So I looked into it, went out to school a few months later. Same school that Blake went to, actually, in Jacksonville, Florida.
About 3 years later, though.
Yeah. And I was wanting to work out in Florida. Didn't work out. So I came back to the West Coast and got on with the company that Blake was at. And that's how I met Blake. So I was working underwater with him for a couple of years or so. Balls to the wall, man. I mean, hard work again.
Yeah.
He got in contact with me about the podcast, and we kind of linked up, and here we are.
Well, that's super cool, man. So it seems like, and maybe I don't know anything about the underwater work that you're doing, but I guess you're fixing stuff mostly, or are you building stuff?
It can vary, man. Like it really,
yeah.
It depends on the job. Every job is different in its own way.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you're building piers and right. you're driving pile. And so sometimes you need a diver down there to be able to inspect, say, when the pile hits its dead stop, and you need to go down and find out potentially if it's hitting a rock, or they'll do a lot of inspection work prior to. You know, so that they know what the ecosystem is on the seabed. And then there's obviously like photos and like it varies, man. Like there's like work where it can be really aggressively physical.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have work where it's like, hey, I need you to go down and just take a photo of, you know, some damage and then come back up. And like you get paid for eight and, you know, all you did was take a photo. So yeah. Yeah, it has its ups and downs, and it's the same way within the industry as far as like scheduling and, you know, workloads. So it comes in waves.
Yeah. So, but welding is obviously a big part of it. Underwater welding, right? Or it could be a big part.
It can be. I mean, there's jobs that call for a lot of welding, but in reality, it's probably less than 10% of a commercial diver's job. To be frank,
it's a skill.
Yeah, there's no such thing as an underwater welder. Like that's not really what we write on our job title. You're a commercial diver who can perform underwater welding, because like I said, there's not many jobs where it's like you go to work, you weld, you get out of the water, you go home, you come back, you weld. It's a lot of like cleaning and inspections and mechanical work. Like, you know, it can really vary. So the reason why I fell in love with this industry so much is because you become a jack of all trades. Mm-hmm. You learn how to work on the water driving boats. You learn how to work on diesel engines, because obviously the motors you're running on those boats are diesel. You have hydraulic systems, you have electrical systems. Like, it, you know, there's so many areas that you can pull from to create a very knowledgeable diver.
Right.
Who could eventually, you know, venture outside of diving and go get a job doing something completely outside of diving, but still has a pertaining to the industry.
Sure.
If that makes sense.
So like, do you guys have your captain's license and can deliver those boats or move those boats if necessary? And you got to have all that, or build over your career. You're going to start building all of these things. You're going to get time on all these boats, and you're going to get a bigger and bigger license and all that.
Exactly. Right? I'm actually a 50 ton captain currently.
Right.
And I'm literally in the process as we speak of acquiring my 100 ton.
Okay.
With a towing endorsement.
So that requires not another test, but just more time on bigger boats, right?
No, there is going
to
be
test at that point.
There's book work. You know, you're dealing with larger boats as well. And you also have to do, there's mathematical equations for like the loads at which you can tow based off of the size of the vessel that you're pulling with. So there's a lot involved in it, but it's honestly not as long as you might think. I mean, you can literally do it in say 3-4 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. But then is it the same as the captain's license that I had, that we took a test for, you know, your general six pack license, and then you just had to have enough hours for that to qualify for that. And then if you had more hours, you could have a higher endorsement, but you didn't have to take another test. And until you get to a higher and higher level, like what you're talking about, and then another test is required, I guess.
Yeah. So we took basically the same test, and I got my 50 ton based off of the hours I acquired on the boats I was driving.
Right.
So now I have to take it again to, or the upgrade, get the upgrade for my captain's 100 ton. Cause now I am now currently working on 100 ton vessels. So just acquiring those hours, and I have to send it in. And from what I was told, I have to retake the test, and I'm actually in time to renew. Okay. My license is in the renewing season.
Yeah. You want to do that because you don't want to have to take that test again. I know that. I don't want to take the test again. I make sure I renew just plenty of time. So as far as the podcast goes, and what you guys, you know, your kind of mission behind this is to show people how they can do something kind of like what you're doing, or even other things that you're not doing, right? Like working on the ocean, working as a part of this lifestyle, which could be what you're doing. It could be, I don't know, fishing guide. It could be something else, right?
Yeah. Ocean conservation is a big thing in our minds as well. Keeping the oceans clean, man. So right now we also do charter boats for like yachts and stuff like that. So we're out on the water constantly doing that as well. And actually the other day we were on a charter, and there was a big old trash bag just sitting out in the ocean. I was like, Blake, we got to go pick that up, man.
I flipped her around and brought her back and back down into position so he could pick up this huge bag of trash just floating offshore. And what did you find, dude?
There was like a backpack, glasses, purse, a bunch of trash, you know, and $10. So Mother Nature paid us $10.
There you go. I got a friend that picks up. He checks everything, man. He's like, you never know, man. One of these times I'm going to find a box of cash, or I'm going to find something. You know, if you look at enough things, you know, there's going to be something good in there one day. Like how many good things have you found? He's like, nothing yet. He keeps looking.
But there's
man.
Always tomorrow.
That's tomorrow. Right, man. You never know, man. Sure. Somebody, you see a backpack floating in the water, man. Never know. Pick what could be in there. Never know, man. Yeah. So what about the Merchant Marines? Like, I remember when my son was getting ready to go to college, and we checked out the Merchant Marines, and I didn't know anything about the Merchant Marines, but it sounds like that might be kind of one way to kind of accomplish what you're talking about.
Merchant Marine is definitely a way,
get your foot in the door kind of thing.
Yeah.
Into the industry to a certain extent.
I'd say so. You were talking about you said your brother is getting involved with that, or
no. My son, when he was getting ready to go to college, just like 5 years ago, we were just kind of at a college fair, and we went by the Merchant Marines, and he was like, you know, the guy was telling us all about it, like what you could do in the Merchant Marines. And it was my first real exposure to the Merchant Marines, but I didn't know if that was something that you guys had any experience with or suggested.
I personally don't have much experience with the Merchant Marine.
If you're talking about people who basically work on board these container ships and tanker ships?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, like, there is an academy. Like, you have the Naval Academy. Each branch of the service has an academy, and the Merchant Marines have an academy. So my son was interested in the Naval Academy. So he didn't pay much attention to the guy from the Merchant Marine Academy, but nobody was talking to the guy. And so he started talking to me, and I was listening, and I was really surprised at the opportunities that there were to go to college, to get a degree, and come out of college having money in your pocket, skills that you had acquired, and potentially have a really good job right out of college working on a ship somewhere. And it was pretty cool. I mean, it was eye-opening, because I didn't know that existed. But, you know, for a young kid that it's probably a really great opportunity for a lot of kids.
I'd say so. You get exposed to a lot of elements of being out at sea.
Well, you know, have you ever heard of a company called Matson? You might have seen a lot of their containers or Connexes that on the back of trucks. Mm-hmm. They're one of the largest merchant mariner companies, shipping companies in the United States and probably across the world. And I have been able to work on a lot of their ships. In fact, they just recently built, I think 2 years ago, the largest U.S. Container ship, which is called the Daniel K. Inouye, which is named after the airport in Hawaii. Right. And I've been able to work alongside these guys because when we go and do any sort of dive work on these ships, we have to board the ship, talk to the chief engineers, talk to the captains, go and perform the lockout tagouts for safety procedures. And these guys are always happy, man. Like, especially those guys, because
they are always happy.
Yeah. They're always going from L.A. to San Francisco to Hawaii. That's their route.
Nice.
And then they just hit all three ports, you know, back and forth. And so they're telling me that when they get to Hawaii, they get a couple of days off. They're like, yeah, man, we got friends and family that live here in Hawaii and we'll just go and surf, barbecue, jump back on the ship, drive to LA. We got friends and family out here. We do the same thing. And yeah. And they're just collecting, you know, and then it is dangerous work depending on what position you carry on those ships. But as long as you're okay with being away from home, that tends to be the most struggling factor when it comes to anything regarding maritime. It takes you away from home and family. And this industry in diving is known for that. And, you know, if you can deal with it, then great. But I've seen a lot of people, struggle with it.
Right. Yeah. It could be really hard on a relationship.
It's good if you're a single young man.
Yeah. And you're probably putting tons of money in the bank because when you're on that ship, you're not spending any money, right?
Well, nowadays they got everything online and the ships carry Wi-Fi. So you can spend your whole paycheck on Amazon if you wanted to, I guess.
You get home and there's a mountain of boxes of shit you don't need.
Yep.
Get to the dock. What is all this for?
Well, you tend to realize as you're purchasing stuff from Amazon on board a ship, your ship is actually carrying your own product you just bought.
Yeah. Man, this is fast. somebody just brings it up from the bottom of the ship. Here, you just ordered this. Thanks.
Amazon's pretty quick, man.
Yeah. So what do you think you're of this whole lifestyle and all these different jobs and skills that you're acquiring? Like, each of you might have different answer for this, but what do you think your favorite part of the way that you make a living? Like, what is it that you really like about what's your best part? Like, if you'd be like, man, if we could just do this all the time, that would be super awesome. Cause I mean, it sounds like you got so many different skills and so many different opportunities and there's so many different jobs that it kind of keeps you moving a lot. But is there one thing that you like the most?
That's a really good question, Tom. I would say, as far as a commercial diving aspect, first off, as soon as you touch the water and you listen to your breath and you collect yourself and you're just with your thoughts, I think that's a cool feeling. First off, being alone underwater and being maybe in possible areas that no man has ever touched is a pretty cool feeling. And as far as like the work, like, hey, I could do this every day. For me, I really love technical work. If I can go do a thruster job every day and get inside a dewatered tunnel and get some wrenches and crank down on some blades and do a blade change out, like, that's just, to me, that's fun. And it's really exciting. And a way to interpret that, do you know what a thruster changeout would be?
Like a bow thruster. I mean, we have those on like a center console boat. It's going to help you to dock. You know, they're going to be about this big. I'm assuming the ones that you're talking about are going to be the size of a house.
Yeah, not really a house, but yes, the tunnels are. How tall are those tunnels?
Well, depends on the size of the ship. The larger ships have a tunnel probably about 10 foot high, like a 10 foot diameter. Uh-huh. And as far as width is concerned, you're probably like, 15 foot in width.
Yeah, 15, 20 feet.
Yeah.
So we go in there and we weld on these doors and we basically dewater the tunnel. So we dive down into the bow thruster tunnel and we go inside, take our gear off.
Basically a habitat.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a habitat. We go in there and work on the thruster, whatever needs to be
you
done.
Go down in there, you weld the doors shut, you get empty the thing of water.
Uh-huh. And we then, leave. There's, like a, there's
your,
like a.
Then you take your gear off and you're working without gear.
Yeah, just your wetsuit or your dry suit, depending
how much,
upon where
how
where
much
you're
oxygen's
at
gonna in be the in world. There. How long can you stay in there?
As long as the surface supplied air is keeping up with what
oh,
you're
so
doing.
There's a surface supplied air
yes,
going into
yes.
there. Okay.
Yes. At all times.
Yeah.
For the whole duration of the job. Yeah.
Wow. And so is that a tricky thing to be able to weld a door underwater, close the door and have it not leak?
So what you do is you get like a steel, what, half inch,
like three eighths plate,
steel plate. We get screw dogs. You know what a screw dog is?
No.
It's like a little L shape that has these screws and it bolts down
okay.
onto the material.
Okay. Yeah.
So we basically weld screw dogs in place around to the size of the door. And then you screw down those screw dogs, tighten the door shut with neoprene so it seals it.
Yep.
And then you leave about a 3-foot gap on the bottom for your air pocket.
And your access point.
Yeah, and your access point on both sides of the tunnel. And then you dewater it, take all the water out. So now you have, since you have that gap there, it's creating an air pocket.
Right.
So you better be a good welder when you're welding your
doors. And so now you're in there, you're screwed and welded in there. How do you get out?
Well, through that access point,
okay.
we leave
gotcha.
About a three-foot gap.
I see.
And Tom, what I'll explain is you probably do know every boat on the bow is shaped in a V formation. Yes.
Right.
Right. So when you are installing these doors, you only install them about 3/4 of the way down the opening to the tunnel. So as the hole becomes shallower, that door is higher up, which leaves you an access point to be able to climb inside, climb out, or send out tools. And in some cases, actually drop the whole entire thruster out through the bottom of the tunnel and through that door. And then you'll have a crane on the outside standing by to be able to take the load and lift it completely up and out.
Wow. So that seems like a pretty advanced operation there, but maybe it's not. I don't know. Is that something that you would have gone over in your school in Jacksonville? Like you would have tested that
not.
Or that is past the school and you got to learn that kind of on the job.
Yeah, this is all on the job training, all on the job training. And
so how do you do that? I mean, that seems super dangerous and it seems like is that a one man job or are there several people doing this?
Oh no, you need a
whole team.
You'll need a 24-hour crew, two teams of, you know, 6 to 8 guys.
So 6 to 8 guys, and you would basically have a new guy that's going to kind of watch a couple of times and then start to become more and more involved. Is that how it works?
That's correct. Yeah. And sometimes the new guy will get in and, you know, do some of the rigging or do.
Nah, more so like as a brand new guy, maybe a new guy who's a year or so in, they will kind of give him little tasks like connecting shackles and things. But in the very beginning, we need to what's called the runner. So the guy who's inside of the habitat performing the actual like thruster job is going to require things like tools and water and even food. So you'll have to have a guy bring down all the things he needs, depending upon what it is. If it needs to stay dry, we have dry boxes, which a dry box, are you familiar with it? It's just basically a big, bucket with an O-ring and you seal it. So whatever is inside stays dry. You bring that down to the diver inside the habitat and then you send back up whatever you don't need. So that runner is basically the new guy and that's his first experience diving on a thruster job or anything regarding a habitat. And as a new diver, to be able to visually see how all that works, it's mind blowing. Like my very first time, like I had the luxury of being able to do it in Cozumel, Mexico. And in Cozumel, your visibility is just like, over 100 feet, you can see everything. Right. And up until that point, I've been diving on these 1,000-foot ships in 3 to maybe 5 foot of visibility. So my scale of things that I'm actually working on in my mind, I'm like, it's not as big as I might think. But the day that I got to dive in Cozumel and make my way down to the propellers, everything was in full view. I mean, you could see the whole entire propeller, the whole rudder, and everything was just huge. Everything was huge. I mean, you're talking about a propeller with like a 30 foot to 35 foot diameter. And at that point you feel like this, you know, you feel like you're just this small, like an inch high, because everything around you is just in full view. So
and that's the propeller on the thruster. What does the main propeller look like on a boat like that?
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm discussing.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. So like the bow thruster props are anywhere between like 6 to maybe 8 foot in diameter.
Right.
But the job that I was performing in Cozumel was similar in the sense that we were using a habitat, but it was on the shaft of the ship where we were exchanging the seals on the shaft. So that propeller was about 35 foot in diameter. Each blade stood at about like 10 to 12 foot.
Wow.
It was insane.
Explain the material of that habitat.
Oh yeah. The material of these habitats, like it's basically a bag, and it's a very, very, very high density material that's cut resistant, heat resistant. And you could probably, I wouldn't do it, but you could take a knife to it. And because of the material that is created out of it, it's just, it'll maintain its strength even through a laceration. And you want that, because when you're working inside of this thing, and it's full of air, you know, if you puncture it, the last thing you want is it just a slice open from top to bottom, because the amount of water that is going to replace that air is going to come on top of you like a semi truck, you know, right onto your head. So it's like a military grade, you know. I can't even describe the material, and I probably shouldn't, in all honesty. This is things that they don't want out. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and so you got to be like the new guy on something like that. Like, how long is it going to be until you're actually being like part of that process or even leading that process? Years?
Well, I mean, for me, it took about 2.5 years, and him, it took even a little bit less, I think.
Yeah. Being a part of the 6 to 8 months of doing this stuff.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And it really comes down to like the team that you're working with, and like, you know, if they need certain guys, you know, like they sometimes like guys are spread thin, because the company that we worked for, they have offices globally, and we repair and maintenance ships all across the globe. So we'd have guys traveling all across the world to fix ships in other places. And when you have a ship that pulls into LA and they're like, hey, you know, we need this done, it's like, well, these are all the guys we got. We got to make it happen. And Dylan was able to do that, and he stepped up and made the job happen and successfully accomplished the goal.
Nice.
Yeah. A lot of it comes down to with those technical jobs is the work ethic as well. You know,
of the whole team,
absolutely. Absolutely. You want everyone to communicate well, and everyone camaraderie, you know, good camaraderie, and everybody gets along and communicates. Communication is key with diving. It really is.
These teams that you have though, Is that a consistent, or are you being constantly put in with other teams and other people and other individuals and all over the place?
Yeah, you're getting constantly thrown around. It's not really steady.
Yeah. So do you have to work on your leadership skills to step into a new group of people
and
gel them together? Or
that's a very good topic, Tom. We brought that up in one of our other episodes. Leadership is a big part of commercial diving.
And it's lacking.
It lacks a large part of it. And we want people to learn, right? You have a new guy coming on board, and people get intimidated. You know, he may do really well. And somebody that's been there for a while are like, this guy's shown me up, you know, and they're going to just kind of put you down on a level that you don't want to be on. So leadership is a big point of why we do this podcast, I think, as far as talking about commercial diving.
And I'd like to make a point real quick. Like, leadership can be performed by anybody. You do not have to be the project manager, the supervisor. You can be the tender. Mm-hmm. You could be the workhorse. You could be the guy swing. You can be right out of dive school and have a leadership mentality. And leadership, just like anything else, is a skill set. you have to work hard to be able to be good at it. Mm-hmm. And if you practice those things, eventually someone will take notice. And you, but you have to be doing it for the right reasons. You have to be, you know, making sure that you're not doing it for the money or just for the title, because the title, the companies will pay anybody for that title. It's like that. I mean, how do I say that? Like I said, leadership is just anyone can perform it. Mm-hmm. And to be, yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about that. I just wonder if you have like some books or people that you kind of pay attention to that in the leadership space, because some of the things that you're saying are similar to some of the things that I've read before. I'm just wondering if you pay attention to that.
I'm a big reader when it comes to books and that talk about that subject. I listened to Simon Sinek. He is a very well knowledgeable man, and as well as Leif Babin and Jocko Willink.
Who wrote
the book Extreme Ownership. And if we had that kind of mentality in this industry, we would be unstoppable. The kind of teams that you could build would be just as efficient and successful as, you know, SEAL teams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting because as soon as you said that, I was like, well, that sounds a lot like Extreme Ownership. Of anyone can be a leader. Because one of the things that I learned in that book, that I've applied all over and helped other people to understand, especially the employees and other things, is like leadership is up and down the chain. So you can lead the people that are above you as well as mm-hmm. they can lead the people that are below them. And, you know, it comes down to like, you know, I don't know. He puts all kinds of examples in there. Like, well, this guy's not a good team player. Well, whose mm-hmm. fault is that? It's your fault because you haven't explained to him what a good team player is. You can lead even though he's a superior. You can somehow explain it to him that, look, all our lives are in each other's hands here. And if, you know, you could be doing this, I don't know, there's a tactful way to communicate that message. And there's a not tactful way to communicate that message, which is not going to be effective at all. But I would think as you're constantly getting thrown into different groups of people, and your life is really in their hands and you've never worked with them before, that's a tricky kind of thing. And you're going to have to become pretty adept at navigating that situation very, very quickly.
And you nailed it right on the head with that, man. That's
exactly how it was when you travel to like overseas. You know, I've worked with guys in Japan who I've never worked with before. And not only have I never worked with them, but they barely speak good English and I don't speak Japanese. So, you know, you tend to have to kind of like work with them and do a lot of like signing almost where mm-hmm. you're kind of like trying to explain. And a good diver who even is 100% Japanese with no English background whatsoever, we were able to communicate, which was, that was amazing. And I will say, like your question you asked earlier about, you know, what about this this industry and this job do we love most? And I think that is one of the most awesome things that I've been able to experience is traveling to other countries, working with people that are in the same industry as me, and we're all there to accomplish one goal, regardless of the obstacles. And by teamwork and, you know, good leadership, you're able to overcome those things and watch a ship that needed a repair, that's carrying products that are going to people all across the world, and to be able to see that ship leave and carry on its objective.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. That was the most rewarding thing. Yeah. And I can't even stress that enough.
That's super cool. I mean, that's super cool because there's like such a bigger, I mean, like as you describe it like that, there's such a bigger purpose in everything that you're doing there. And you realize that, which I think is super cool. You're not just out there fixing a ship. I mean, there might be medical supplies on that boat that are going to save lives, like, or lots of people are going to die if they don't get those medical supplies. I mean, that's on the one end of the extreme spectrum. Then there's a 14-year-old girl that's going to scream her head off if she doesn't get the thing that she just ordered from Amazon. So You're saving parents around the world. Yeah. I've had 14-year-old girl that screams her head off. That's cool, man. I mean, it's such a cool lifestyle and really, really cool to kind of, for you guys to be sharing this, because I really do believe that, you know, coming from I'm an outsider, but I mean, I'm familiar with the ocean. I know a lot of people that work in the ocean. I know lots of captains and they run all kinds of different boats. But like what you said, like there's no such thing as an underwater welder. I would think that there was such a thing as an underwater welder, that's kind of what you would do. But the way that you guys are explaining it, it is even more attractive as a career to be thinking that all the while that you're doing your job, you're acquiring these skills, you're becoming a jack of all trades, just like you said. And along the way, you're getting licenses and accreditations and more experience and travel opportunities. Like it seems like the travel, like now you guys seem like you've been doing this long enough to be really like kind of happy with where you are or whatever, but is there enough work around you that you can kind of stay where you are, or are you still doing all of this travel, or is that part of the lure? Like, do you want all this travel? I mean, I don't know where are you guys with that?
Yeah. So right now I'm not currently, in with the company. Blake and I actually are together doing freelancing. So you kind of put your names in with, several dive companies and you get a call, a couple of days before, sometimes the day of, hey, we have this job coming up. Do you want to take it or not? And you say, yes. You know, you got your dive gear, you show up on site, you go to work, come home, get paid. And that's kind of where we're at now. You know, we really want to get this podcast rolling and things going with the new lifestyle. But freelancing, I like it because I have a lot more free time on my hands. You know, I'm not like commercial diving, coming from a lifestyle with no schedule. There is no schedule when you're a diver. You come out of dive school, you get in with the company. You have to say yes to a lot of things and no to a lot of things, personal time. There is no like, okay, your job is Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. No, it's Monday, we got a 12-hour shift. Tuesday, we got an 8-hour shift. Wednesday, you got the day off. Thursday, let's do a 16-hour shift. Friday, I don't know, I'll call you if something comes in. Saturday, oh, come in at 4 a.m., you got a hole clean. Sunday, come in at 3 a.m., you got another hole clean. You know, there is an unpredictable schedule with diving. So,
and that's for like ship husbandry. But if you're getting more involved in like the oil and gas industry, it's almost the same thing, but you're going to be gone for longer periods of time. So you'll get that phone call. They'll say, be at the dock at 0600 and the ship leaves, out to the rigs offshore. And then you're there for 2 to 3 months and then come home with a big fat check, similar to the same idea of offshore fishing.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see those guys, when we fish in Louisiana, you know, we fish around those rigs and man, it's like a city up there. I mean, some of those things are so big. Sure. It really is like a city, but I mean, I guess they have helicopters that are coming out there all the time. So I guess they're having crew change and shift change and nobody misses a beat, man. I mean,
I'll tell you, man, I one of my favorite experiences was actually going offshore. I lived on one of those dynamic positioning vessels for about a month and a half.
What was it called?
It was called the Danny Atkins.
Okay. I don't know if that's the one. We fished right next to one of those or a couple of different ones. And the guide that we were with was like, that thing's not, it's just floating there. Like that's not dynamic positioning thing ship. Is what you're saying. Explain how that works just quickly.
Yeah. So, these vessels are there to basically drill the wellhead, which will then remove that ship will then leave. And then they will then build the production rig directly over that wellhead. And the way it works is it's all ran by computer systems and they'll have a set of thrusters. Some have one on every corner of the ship. Some have, you know, two on every corner and then one on port and one on starboard. And this thing is sitting on two pontoons. And you have a total of, which is common, six columns that support the structure above it. And those thrusters are set to a coordinates by a computer system. And then that ship will remain on those coordinates And if it starts to drift off, those thrusters will fire up and then put the ship directly back into position. And that's all happening while the drill operation is actively going on. They'll have that drill going down to, you know, depending upon how deep they want to drill into that well, you know, 800 feet, 1,000 feet, whatever. And those drills are they're technical. I mean, those things can move like a snake. You know, they're not rigid. They can bend, they can twist, they can turn. So, you know, that ship isn't really stuck in one exact point, meaning that like, if it moves a little bit, that well is going to snap, or the pipe snap, but it, you know, it will stay in position. And, it's pretty amazing. And I was out there, we were removing those thrusters. They were needing some refurbishing. So we removed them, and, you know, as we're removing one by one by one, the ship is basically losing its control to steer, right? So as we got down to the last two of them, the way that we actually were able to remove them and keep the ship in one spot was we had two tugboats, massive tugs, come offshore, and they basically played tug of war with the ship.
Wow.
While we were sitting at about like 185 feet of water or so, maybe a little more, 200 or so. And we were diving down to 115, to be able to make the transition with the thruster to the crane. And that's all happening while these tugs are just pulling to keep it in one spot. So it was very, very exciting.
Wow. That's super cool. Yeah. That whole concept, I was trying to get my head around the concept while we're fishing for tuna right next to this thing. And he's like, yeah, it doesn't, it's just floating there. It's moving and there's thrusters and it's doing just what you're saying. And it's such a huge thing. It's like, man, that thing can sit in no matter what the wind is doing, no matter what the tide or the current is doing, that thing can sit in exactly the same spot. That's amazing. I mean, it really is cool. Amazing.
And, you know, being able to be on like a crew boat and getting transferred to that ship, that is by far one of the most exciting things I've ever done. Better than any roller coaster ride I've ever been on. Like, you get out there on these crew boats and they have a man basket that is basically like, you can sit four or five guys and you stand on it, wrap your arms around the cables, and the crane operator who's on board the ship that you're about to board will lift you up 250 plus feet into the air off of the crew boat with your backpack on and carry you up and over the ocean and land you onto the helicopter deck.
And what the weather's doing, right?
Well, no, they plan accordingly, right? So like the crew boats are aware of like the storms that are in the area, and you know, there is safety protocols.
Yeah, but still, I mean, if it's slick calm or if it's blowing 20, there's a big difference from that. And probably both are safe, but 20 is going to be a wild ride, man.
Yeah, well, let's just say, like, you know, in his situation, being up in Alaska, 50-foot seas, I think they call an all stop.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So let me ask you what everybody wants to know. What about wildlife, specifically sharks? Sharks. Swordfish. Did you ever see the video? I'm sure you have, of it underwater. Maybe it was one of you guys. I don't know. It was a diver. He was on one of these rigs and a swordfish comes and it, like, I don't know if it was going for the dude, but it gets stuck in this kind of ladder looking apparatus. I guess it was a ladder. I don't know what it is, but dude, I mean, a swordfish is a serious fish.
He was on bottom. That was a deep saturation dive.
Yeah. So what about wildlife? Is it a concern? Is it something that you just, how do you deal with it? What do you think?
I've personally never seen sharks out in Florida in like dive school, like a bull shark here and there.
Just a little bull shark. But
yeah, a little bull shark.
I've had the luxury of seeing a total of two. One tiger shark in Hawaii and one great white just off the coast of California right here in our backyard. The tiger shark that was in Hawaii was had a name, like the locals there actually had a name for it, and because it was commonly coming into the harbor, and we're about to jump in the water and they're like, I forget the name they named her, but I think Betty for the sake of the story,
or something nice, like cupcake,
something
so you won't be afraid of it,
something sweet. So she comes in and I guess, and I told my buddy I'm working with, I'm like, dude, there's a tiger shark over there. He's like, yeah, don't worry about her. She's fine. Just carry on with your business. And I'm like, Roger that. So had it up, jumped in the water, you know? And at that point you have to maintain your focus. You can't think and create this story of what could happen, because that is going to be you're your own worst enemy. You know, especially guys who dive in black water, you dive in black water, just close your eyes. Don't start thinking about what's in the dark, because the second you do that, that's when you start getting paranoia. You start getting, you know, you're hyperventilating, your heart rate jumps, and then that's when bad things can go even worse. So,
yeah,
you know, you got to just remain calm. And my experience of that is true in this dive I had just off the coast of California here, where we were working for the Edison power plant, the nuclear power plant, I should say, just off Camp Pendleton. And we were making a lot of noise. We were core drilling into this concrete structure that sits over the pipelines that take the water in to cool the reactors. And as we're making all kinds of noise, you know, we're like bringing in all kinds of just sea life. I mean, there were sheep's head, you know, calico bass, halibut, lobsters were, you know, as far as the eye can see, dude. I mean, they were everywhere. But yeah, I mean, as we're doing this, you know, we're working, and all of a sudden we see this about 13 to 15 foot, maybe, great white coming into the job site.
Oh, boy.
And as we're sitting there, like, I'm looking at it and I can communicate with my diver. So for those listening who don't know, we can communicate to each other underwater because our umbilicals, which carry our comms cable, runs to the surface and all comes to a comm box so that we can all communicate, the guy up top, myself, and my dive mate. So I tell my other buddy, like, hey, man, what do you want to do? And he's like, don't worry about it. Just keep working. And as a diver, you're safer. You're safer in the water when it comes to sharks than you are, say, swimming or surfing. But like I said, don't let that shy you away from going in the ocean, because you're more likely to get attacked or get struck by lightning than attacked by a shark.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're scared to go in the water, if you're listening to this, don't not go in the water because of sharks, because sharks aren't monsters that Jaws made them out to be.
It's those sea lions, man. Those sea lions will get you more than anything else.
I would imagine that they would. I would imagine. I mean, those things are more like a dog. Like they just come up and bite you. Like
there's so many of them
for no reason.
Here.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of different things. I mean, sharks are one thing, but the sea lions, the swordfish, that's a serious one. We had our underwater diver got attacked by a swordfish, and it was
you serious?
Yeah, it was no joke. I'll send you the video after this. It's on my Instagram. But we were in Louisiana, and our diver, he's very accomplished and he's experienced, and he's been spearfishing in the Keys all his life since he was a little boy, and he's been the underwater diver for our show for a long time. And so the swordfish is coming up, and our diver got in the no-go zone. Like he was between the fish and the boat, and that's a no-go, because now like the angler is pulling the fish to you. Uh-huh. So if you're on the other side of the fish, at least you have something stopping the fish, right? Like there's a pull on the line, or you could be on the other side of the boat. So at least you have something between you and the fish. He got between the fish and the angler. And this swordfish is going right along like this. And you see, I'll send you this video and you can look at it on Instagram too, but you can see his eye shift like this. And he's like, oh, you're the problem. And turns, and I mean like fast, like his tail comes, and he's holding an underwater camera, and it's made out of you know, high impact plastic, and has a frame on the front, but the bill goes into the camera, probably about that far, and breaks off. And then, you know, he's like, whoa, and you know, continues to film, because he's like you guys. He's like, okay, do the job, you know. Okay, but I mean, the danger was over right then. And then, you know, shortly after, here comes the gaff, and they get the fish. But we all were like looking at that, and finally we go to pull that thing out, and none of us could get it out. It was like the sword of Excalibur, man. That thing was in there so deep and penetrated into that plastic so hard, we couldn't ever get it out. We had to break the thing to get the bill out because he's like, I want that. I want that piece, right?
Put it on your wall.
Yeah. But it's you know, those swordfish are no joke, and that's the last time that we'll be diving with the swordfish. Now, sailfish, different story. Never had any problem with those. Never seen any aggression whatsoever. I mean, you could probably have an accident with a swordfish or a sailfish where they're jumping and maybe they jump and come down and you happen to be right there and you could take a bill. But the swordfish, and I don't know about marlin, they could probably be aggressive, but I can tell you that sawfish and swordfish are aggressive. Two things that I don't want to fish. I don't want to swim with. Like those things.
Yeah.
That sawfish is also another really, really bad one, man. Because
I would imagine even a sawfish, when you catch it, bring it up on deck, what it does.
Well,
you know?
I mean, they're so big. We have caught baby sawfish where you could actually pick the thing up, but for the most part, the sawfish that we encounter in the Florida Keys are usually when you're tarpon fishing, you got a dead bait on the bottom and you don't know what picked it up, and all of a sudden you have this 16 foot long fish on. Now 7 feet of it is a bill, you know, or 6 feet, it is the bill, and a lot of it's the tail, so the actual animal is not 16 feet long. But I mean, you get this thing near your boat and you're like, damn, this is close to as long as my boat. I mean, this is a huge thing. But as they get mature and they get really big, that bill and the teeth off of that bill get really, really, really long. And you would make a horrible mistake to reach down for that thing. But there's some videos that have been going around. A lot of people have been catching them this year, and you know, they're just pulling up on the leader. They think, oh, this is a ray. We do fish in really clear water a lot of times, but if you go back in the Everglades, the water can be really muddy and you don't know what you have for a while. It could be a shark, could be a ray, could be a nurse shark, you know, that doesn't fight real hard. It could be a ray that you're having trouble pulling up off the bottom. So, you know, the guide's leadering this thing and all of a sudden the bill comes up and you know, real sharp and fast movements and hits the boat and the guy like jumps out of the way. But that's no joke, because that's what they do. Like they go into a school of mullet and they just start doing their bill like this. And, you know, but they're, you know, they like to live in murky water. Like that's how they make their living. They go into a school of mullet and they start doing that bill
away.
And they're going to hit some things and they're going to fall to the bottom and then they're going to go back around and they're going to eat all that stuff up off the bottom. Mm-hmm. And, but that's a scary one. Hopefully you never encounter one of those. I would imagine if you encountered it as a diver, it wouldn't be aggressive whatsoever. I would think that it would just go on its own way, like a ray or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think the problem comes when you try to handle the thing, like you try to get the hook out of it or whatever, and all of a sudden it's like handling a live chainsaw, not a good idea, you know.
Yeah, of course. Sure.
Yeah. So one more curiosity that I have: what would you consider to be a really deep working dive? And what is a routine working dive, and what would you consider a shallow dive? And also like the time that you're spending down there, because you're using different gear than your recreational scuba diver. So I would think that most of the people that are listening to this, you know, spearfish, dive, get lobsters, stuff like that, they're kind of familiar with the tables and how long you should be able to stay down. But you guys are doing like different things, like with your dive helmet right there. And I don't know.
Yep. 17 Bravo. That's the model of that hat right there, which is in the industry, it's called a hat.
Okay. I'll be sure to call it that from now on. It'll seem like I know what I'm talking about.
Right on.
Cool hat, bro.
I think with surface supplied air, without having to change your air gas mixture, would probably be a deep dive, would be 250. Right, that'd be a deep dive. 100 feet would be a deep dive.
Yeah,
I mean, because I mean, really, but
in all honesty, it's based off of if you're still diving air, because the moment you change from air to mixed gas, that's considered deep diving. And now you're getting into the realm of CERTIO2s, which is surface decompression, which is when you get put inside of the chamber and then it's a controlled decompression system. So at that point, it would be considered deep. But for the most of the work that we, myself and Dylan do, it's all on air.
Like 40 feet?
Yeah. Like the deepest dive I've ever done on air was 185. Mm-hmm. And you get what's called nitrogen narcosis, which is has the same effects of kind of being drunk.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to kind of function and still perform your job in those circumstances. Now, when you dive that deep on air, you're still abiding by the U.S. Navy dive tables. So your time at that depth is very limited. You have like 4 or 5 minutes to perform your work. And that's where the big money jobs come in, because you have to consistently change out guys because you can only perform work for so long. But the time that you're spending the rest of the day basically is inside the chamber and doing your decompression. And once that decompression is done, you know, you're done for the day and you tend or whatever. But
yeah, you get paid for the whole day.
But like, what would you say would be like an average dive for us?
An average dive would probably be, 35 feet.
Yeah, 35 foot, which 35. Means that you can stay there for a total of 232 minutes without coming up to the surface. So once your time is up, that's your day. And now you're there to tend or, you know, drive the boat or whatever you need to do up top. Mm-hmm. But shallow water, anything above 20 feet, as per Navy dive tables, it's considered unlimited. So we've spent, myself and Dylan have spent hours and hours and hours at 20 feet. Like the longest time I've ever been underwater per se, which is inside of the habitat we spoke of earlier, was 14 hours without coming up.
Wow.
Yeah. My first job as a runner on a SEAL job in San Diego, that was my first, what's the word I'm looking for? Technical job. It was like 12 hours, just taking tools and back and forth to the divers in the habitat.
In
the
what water happens the if you have to pee?
Well, you pee do the deed.
You just got to go, right?
You do the deed.
Unless you're in a dry suit. I mean, you can cut out probably real quick.
And, yeah. You don't want to pee in a dry suit.
Or they make little pee valves for your dry suit now.
Really?
You can install a valve. I don't know how much they are.
We don't need to get too in-depth on that one, though.
They're like a couple
of hours. I mean, that's the question everybody wants. I mean, you're like 14 hours? My God, I'd have to pee like 10 times.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you do the business. In the habitat, you're able to kind of handle your business a little bit easier, per se, because you're inside of the habitat where you took all your gear off,
right?
You know, and you take care of your business without coming up, and then you just put your suit back on and carry on your way. But there has been dives where you're like, because like our dive hoses are about 600 feet in length, some of them. And when you're 600 feet away from the boat and you're performing a certain job, sometimes you have to make a decision. You know, it's like, well, do I want to swim all the way back, wait for my tender to come up on all that hose, climb up the ladder, take all my gear off, unzip, find my, the toilet, which could be on the dock, like 100 yards away.
That would have to be the biggest emergency in the history. Yeah.
Or the alternative is to remove your bailout in the water with your helmet on and hold your bailout with you and then undo your wetsuit, pull your wetsuit down to your ankles while trying to swim or hang on to something. Perform your business and then pull the suit back up and put your gear back on and not even tell topside what's going on. So
just
they don't
be in the water.
They don't even know what's happening down there. You're just down there doing your thing.
Sounds like you just should be really careful about your intake before a long dive like that.
Yeah. So you gotta lay back on the coffee, lay back on the anything tobacco, as you chew tobacco. Smoke. And just take it easy before you get in the water. No heavy big lunches or breakfasts.
Yeah, because that's coming out, man. That's coming out. And that sounds like a problem either way. I mean, that's a lot of
thinking. It can be pretty shitty.
Yeah, I guess fully pun intended. That's cool, man. Well, you guys got an awesome lifestyle, man. You got a cool podcast. You got what's the apparel company?
It's Hangin' Lead.
So this, hanging lead.
I don't know if you can see this, but I can see.
It's an awesome logo, man. You got the hat, you got the fishing rods. See, I call it both the right thing. Like, it's not fishing poles, it's fishing rods.
Yeah. And this is called the traditional Mark V, which is, you know, iconic. Everyone knows what that looks like.
Yeah. It's like that movie when the dive movie with Cuba Gooding Jr. and
That's it.
And he put
Men of Honor.
Yeah, that was such a cool scene when he what did he have to do there? He had to put that on. And what did he do?
He had to take like 100 steps or something with his gear on. Right?
Yeah.
He had to walk with it because he had lost his leg in that diving accident.
Right. Yeah. Right. That was a great movie.
Yeah, do it in the courthouse.
Is that the River Runs Through It of dive movies? Like, I don't know. A River Runs Through It was like made everybody that ever thought that they might want to go fly fishing, made them actually go.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I'll have to watch that one. That's a great one. There's also a movie called Pioneer.
Oh, Pioneer!
Oh, yeah.
Which is a great movie. It's
Last
the true
Breath as well.
Yeah, Last Breath is a great one. The Pioneer is the true story about the American divers working with the Norwegians to be able to dive to depths well beyond their means at that time because the Americans had the breathing gas mixture correct, and the Norwegians were in need of it to perform the work that they were doing because in off the coast of Norway, the water depth is like 1,000+, and they were installing the first oil pipeline out of the North Sea and bringing it into Norway. So they had to perform habitat work actually on the ocean floor at 1,000 feet, but they had to breathe they had inside of a habitat. So it was all dewatered and this structure sat over the pipeline and they performed their work.
What was the way that they got to 1,000 feet? They would have to take that habitat down they're not going by themselves down there.
No.
Right?
So that's a whole nother topic. That's what saturation diving is. Very, very technical, very in depth. When you're diving to those depths, your body has to become acclimated to the environment.
Right.
So you actually are living inside of the best way to describe it would be like hamster tunnels that are on board the ship that is pressurized to the same working depth that your current like the job is at. So if the job is at 1,000 feet, the pressure inside of that living quarters with your bed, your toilet, your kitchen, everything is it's pressurized to 1,000 feet, and they have what's called the dive bell, which is a system that the divers enter that can be removed from the actual living quarters and then lowered through the center of the ship, what's called the moon pool. So they lower that diving bell with the divers in it all the way down to the depth of the job. And when the pressure becomes equal, they are allowed to then open the door and then basically get down to the job. So it's as if they're taking the bus to work, doing their job, get back in the bus, and then taking the bus back up to home.
It's literally being an aquanaut.
Yeah, is wild, man. Is that healthy? I mean, are there any effects from living like that for extended period of time?
When performed correctly, then, no. I mean, there are obvious like stresses on the body, you know, such as working hard and physically exerting yourself at those depths. But when you're working at those depths, it's not about working hard. It's about working smart. Mm-hmm. Because if you work too hard, you could potentially, you're more at risk of getting DCS, which is decompression sickness, also known as the bends.
Yeah. So when they finish the job and they go back up through the moon pool and they get back up and they will hook back up into the hamster tunnels, and then how long will they live in there? Will they just start to slowly change that pressure, or what will they?
I think it's like a month of decompression.
A month?
Yeah. So they're living in there for about a month.
Those guys had to make $1 million. Like, they were in there for a month, then they go down and do a little work, and then they come up and live there for a month again?
Yeah, they're making a good amount of money.
I think it's like $1,000 a day or something like that.
Yeah, 1,000 to like 1,500.
Dang.
Yeah. And there's obvious hazard pay involved on that as well.
Yeah. Right.
Now they're making some money for sure.
But like I said earlier, you have to be okay with being away from home from that long. And the movie that that Dylan brought up earlier called Last Breath is a great true story. Both these movies, Pioneer and Last Breath, are based off of true events. And The movie Last Breath is it's a little bit nerve-wracking for those interested in getting into this industry, because it has, you know, this job has potential dangers. If you don't understand that and think that it's all going to be hunky-dory, then it's not for you. But, you know, if you have the adrenaline junkie kind of attitude, and you're willing to, you know, do things like slow is smooth and smooth is fast. That's a common thing in the industry. You have to work smart and slow and smoothly, because it's better than working fast, abruptly, and causing more problems. And at those depths, it's life or death.
Wow. Man, it's fascinating. Dude, I learned so much talking to you guys. It's awesome. We got to do this again. I'd love to have you guys on again. I'm going to listen to a bunch of your podcasts, and it's cool, man. What a interesting way to make a living. I mean, it really is. And I'm not a complete outsider, but you know, there's a lot of interesting things. I had no idea there was that much involved in it. So really cool, man. Really cool.
Yeah, we look forward to it. We look forward to maybe having you come on onto our show as well.
Let's do it, man. I don't know what I can. Absolutely. We'll talk about sawfish and swordfish and dangerous things that'll make people look over their shoulder.
I got to tell you, Tom, it's a dream of mine to have my own fishing charter business.
Right on. Do it.
Yeah. That is a big dream of mine.
Well, we'll make it happen.
You're in a great place there in Southern California. There's tons of great fishing there. I mean, I know like lots of good opportunities there. Everything from the big sturgeon that they have, and I had some friends there, and they would fish the striped bass and the tuna and some great trout fishing there. I mean,
we're starting to get yellowtail coming up from Mexico right now. So yellowtail's on its way, and mahi is definitely right behind it.
Yeah. Right. Well, we can certainly talk about the road to becoming a charter guide if you want to do that when I come on your show. But happy to do it anytime, man.
And Hanging Lead will sponsor the whole thing.
Okay. Yes.
Love it. I love it. All right, man. Well, thanks so much for spending time with us, and tell everybody where they can find your podcast and how they can buy your shirts and everything else.
Yeah. So if you guys go to www.hanginleadapparel.com, that's our site for our apparel. Right now we're doing a bit of a sale. We're getting some new merch coming up pretty soon. It's going to be some pretty cool designs coming your guys' way. Should be good stuff.
Yep. And you can find the Instagram on hangin_lead. And you can also follow the podcast as well on Instagram, which is under Breakdown the Dive, all one word. And we are currently on all platforms, including Spotify, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, as well as iHeartRadio. And we are also on Waypoint TV along with Tom Roland.
Right on. I love the plug there. Nice. It's really sweet.
And if anybody is interested in the industry, man, feel free to give us a little message on Instagram or an email through our Instagram there. We're more than welcome to talk with you guys and about the industry.
Yeah. And also, like, me and Dylan both came from backgrounds originally with no ocean experience. You know, I came from the restaurant industry. He came from retail, and you can make it. It doesn't matter, you know, what your background is. What matters is how bad do you want it? You know, it's not about the size of the dog. It's about the size of the fight in the dog. So if you are willing to push your limits, you know, get with the right people. It's all about who you surround yourself with. Like, I surrounded myself with a bunch of ex-military guys who were over in Iraq and Afghanistan, and those guys put themselves through hell. And while I was in dive school, those guys were the ones that gave me motivation to push my limits past what I thought was possible, because, you know, I didn't think that I was capable of those things. But when you're around a good group of guys and who are willing to help you, and, you know, you'll be surprised on how far you can go. And that's what we're here for. So anyone that has questions regarding the industry of diving, captaining, surfing, fishing, anything ocean related, we're here at your disposal.
Absolutely. And go ahead. Getting into an industry, it's very important for the listeners to know. You should always know your why. Always know why you're doing it, and know your why. Take you. Know your why.
It's awesome, man. Those are good messages. A lot of people need to hear that, especially with people that, you know, this last year, you have a lot of people kind of questioning what it is that they're doing. Is this really what they want to do? A lot of people kind of send me some sort of message about, you know, thinking about becoming a fishing guide or getting into fishing retail or really just changing, you know, from one job to another. And it's really a message that people need to hear, is that you can do it. Like, it's not about experience. It's not about, you know, not even really about who you know. I mean, between the three of us right here, we got into some sort of career that was pretty unlikely. And these are the type stories that I really like on this podcast. You know, whether that's somebody becoming a professional backpacker, which I have had that guest on, which is super unlikely. She just became a professional backpacker because she hated her job and she wanted to do it differently. Yep. And so she makes YouTube videos and she's doing quite well. But I have a ton of different guests that have made this really unlikely career jump into something that they had no experience with, they had no connections, but they really wanted to do it for whatever their own reasons were. And just like you say, man, if you have a good reason why you want to do it and you're not afraid to work really hard, you can make anything happen. Despite how difficult or competitive that job field seems to be, it is possible. And there's always room for somebody that's willing to work harder than everybody else. I mean, it's just the way it is. You guys see it. I see it. But the person that is making that jump has trouble seeing it sometimes because they're looking at it like we're all looking at it from a place of, I came from not knowing anyone and not having any experience. Looking back on it, there really weren't as many challenges as I thought there were. Mm-hmm. But when you're on the other side of that, looking at something, it looks impossible. And sometimes people just need somebody like you guys just to tell them that it is possible. And in fact, I'll even give you a little hand. Like, don't do this, do this. Mm-hmm. This is a good path. That one, not so good. You know?
And the harder the obstacle, the better the reward.
That's right. I believe that fully. I believe that fully. Well, you guys are cool dudes, man. I'd like to come to California and hang out. I love that area,
Let's
man.
Do
it's,
it, Tom.
It's super cool. One of my favorite places is Encinitas. Where are you around that? Carlsbad, Encinitas, kind of.
We're about an hour north.
Okay, an hour north. Yeah, my wife and I drove that whole thing from the SEAL base, Coronado, all the way up to basically L.A. And turned around when we got to LA and went back the other way.
Come out and go fishing. Blake's building his boat here in the driveway. He's got a nice boat. I got my little lure sport fishing boat. We can all go do some offshore fishing.
Sounds
and have a good
time. Man. As long as you keep me out of that dive suit, I'll be happy.
No promises.
All right, man. All right. I would like to do some spear fishing out there. That'd be pretty cool. I think.
We're linking up with 7C Spearfishing, who we just recorded with yesterday, who's based out of Long Island. Okay. And we're trying to get him out of here too.
Right on. Well, I'll let you know when I come out there. But far as today goes, man, that was awesome. I enjoyed the stories. I enjoyed everything. Let me know when you want to do your podcast. I'll be happy to be on there. And
Sounds good.
Otherwise, check out their podcast, man. Lots of cool stories, lots of cool eye-opening things. But thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Tom.
We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, thank you.
Talk to you later, man.